the headlines this hour. Tehran preparing to host an Afghan neighbors conference. Iran says Afghans will only accept a government that represents all ethnic groups and reflects their will. The state of emergency in Sudan. The opposition is calling for civil disobedience against a military coup that has just toppled the transitional government. Also in the headlines, Russia reports another record in its daily COVID fatalities as authorities try to curb the pandemic by reimposing lockdown measures. This is news. Thanks for joining us. A high-level meeting of Afghanistan's neighbors in Tehran is set for this Wednesday. Iran says the gathering aims to send a unified message of support for the Afghan people.
The message from Tehran's meeting tomorrow is that the people of Afghanistan will only accept a government that reflects their will and represents their ethnic makeup. We are hoping to witness an inclusive mechanism in Afghanistan with help from all the countries involved and away from foreign interference.
Khatibzadeh added that participants in the Tehran meeting will also send the message that Afghanistan should not become a hotbed for terrorism, extremism, and violence. He said that it is unacceptable for Afghanistan to backtrack in security, social, and political areas. The spokesman also highlighted protection of people of Afghanistan and their rights as a key priority. Neighbors of Afghanistan plus Russia will get together in Tehran's peace conference. UN Director General Antonio Guterres will also deliver an online speech at the event. Palestinian people have had enough of Israeli atrocities, and it is now time that the international community held Israel accountable for its crimes. That's a message from the Iranian mission to the United Nations. The mission says collective action is needed to prevent Israel from committing more war crimes and crimes against humanity. Tehran is proposing that restrictions be placed on any economic activity that would prolong the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Iran's reaction comes as the UN Special Rapporteur has just delivered an annual report on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. Michael Link has called for, quote, a meaningful cost on Israel for its endless occupation. Human rights organizations have sounded the alarm on the deteriorating water situation in the Gaza Strip, which threatens the lives of each resident in the impoverished enclave, Ruba Shepherd reports.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spread in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Israel's decision to build hundreds more settler units in the occupied West Bank has drawn criticism from the European Union. We discussed the matter with our guest in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
The European Union calls on Israel to reconsider a plan to build 1,300 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, a spokesman from the bloc's executive commission called the regime's settlement activities illegal and a major obstacle to achieving any lasting solution between the parties. The spokesman added that the EU will not recognize Israeli settlements constructed after the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories. Israel announced its plans to build new units on Friday. That's while all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law, as they are built on occupied land. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in several resolutions. Joining us is Jonathan Kotab, a Palestinian human rights lawyer, and also Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Gentlemen, welcome. Jonathan, I believe we heard a similar statement from the European Union many decades ago. They're very good at issuing statements, but where's the action?
I think you have to ask that to European diplomats and not to me. It's obvious that we Palestinians are very disappointed that the European Union is allowing Israel to get all the benefits of membership in the EU almost without any of the obligations. For example, many of their trade agreements specifically strike out the clause that requires respect for human rights. They just want to have the benefits, the trade, the cultural exchanges, the scientific exchanges, access to research funds, but not human rights obligations.
Right. And Edward, where is the responsibility of the European Union, the United Kingdom that created this Zionist entity, or the United States that continues to support it to this day? Where is their responsibility to hold Israel accountable? Where is the UN Security Council to hold Israel accountable for violating literally every international law?
Well, talk is cheap. If you talk, you just create hot air, but nothing tangible comes out of it. And the UN Security Council has passed probably close to 100 resolutions condemning various Israeli policies. The European Union frequently condemns them, but they don't take action. And, you know, so to look at what they do, not what they say. The problem is broader in that a lot of the Arab countries talk itself. In fact, you know, you have Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Sudan. Well, it was interesting to see what happens with Sudan. But, you know, recognizing Israel and then saying and doing nothing when Israel, you know, is attacking and killing Palestinians or bombing Syria and, you know, violating Lebanese airspace. It's an entirely one-sided equation. Israel can basically do what it wants and without any consequences. And in fact, the Israelis ultimately are getting rewarded by the Americans because they've increased the funding for Israel and given them, you know, money to replace the Iron Dome. And, you know, it's a long litany of you know words but no action. And this is the problem. So you really have to, but they're supporting this and they turn a blind eye to Israel's settlements. There are 600,000 settlers now in East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank, and that creates a huge political force, democratic system, which is for Jews only, but the West Bank, they all have the right to vote, and no party is going to that block, and it's the reason why getting further and further to the right as as some Israeli act slow motion genocide and creeping, and they just continue to do it with virtual consequences. And BDS has put a little bit of power, Ben and Jerry are not selling the occupied territories. So these are small steps, but nothing that really is a threat to Israel. And they may have a little bit of bad press, but they just keep going on and they wink wink and they continue with their policies,
right?
And it's the Palestinians that suffer the result.
Right. So, Jonathan, just coming back to you, this statement by the European Union, which we hear pretty much every year on an annual basis, is do you see any tangible results coming out of that? Or is perhaps resistance against the Israeli occupation the sole way to liberate Palestinian land and for Muslims and Christians to pray at the holy sites in occupied al-Quds in for Muslims to pray in the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
No, that is not my view. My view is that international law and respect for human rights is the path to go. And I think that we need to call Europe, as well as the United States, but certainly Europe, to its obligations under the Geneva Convention. Article 1 of the Geneva Convention requires every party to ensure compliance with the Geneva Convention. So that if the European governments do not do enough to ensure compliance with the Geneva Conventions, they themselves are therefore violating international law. This is something that you can only get if you engage directly with the Europeans and call them to their responsibilities under international law. And I think the program should invite European diplomats to see what they say. How do they explain the fact that they are basically violating international law by not living up to their obligation to ensure compliance with the Geneva Convention?
Thank you very much. So as the Israelis laugh at the Palestinians' cry. Let me thank our guests for their contribution and their time. Jonathan Kutab is a Palestinian human rights lawyer, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review.
Sudan's main opposition coalition has called for peaceful escalation against a military takeover in the country. Alliance, known as Forces of Freedom and Change, demanded nationwide protests and civil disobedience against the military's move. Earlier in a televised speech, the ruling council head, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, declared a state of emergency and announced the dissolution of the transitional government. However, he vowed to form what he called a competent government and pledged a transition to a civilian state. The Information Ministry described the decision as a coup. According to the ministry, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok had been detained and moved to an unknown location. Meanwhile, demonstrators hit the streets of several cities to decry the military takeover of the country. The protesters in the capital, Khartoum, and the most populated city of Omdurman, chanted slogans against military rule and burned tires. Health officials say that 7 people were killed and 140 others were injured in clashes between protesters and military forces. Sudan has been ruled by an interim government since the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. However, tensions have been running high between civilian and military leaders since a failed coup attempt in September. Political commentator John Philpott says any government in Sudan should change the country's policy on ties with Israel.
We have seen the so-called democracy movement and which appears to be pro-Western, they recognized Israel. They turned over Mr. el-Bashir to the ICC, which is unthinkable. The ICC only has accused Africans up to now, and it's clearly a pro-Western court. So right now, it looks to me like the people in the government of the power in the Sudan is not happy with the pro-Israeli Zionist colonialist approach, and they want to rectify the wrongs done politically in the orientation of their government. I must say, a lot of us don't like coups. It's not something which we admire. But we notice the hypocrisy because the U.S. did not condemn the coup in Guinea. So they have no standing, in my opinion. My reading of this, and I say that very humbly, I see it as a reaction to the pro-Western turn in the Sudan.
There has been a sudden influx of new COVID cases in Russia in the past days, reporting a new all-time high for daily fatalities. The country is now struggling to bend the curve with lockdown measures. Just in the past 24 hours, more than 1,100 people have died of the respiratory disease. It is the seventh consecutive day that Russia is reporting over 1,000 fatalities. The overall death toll now hovers around 230,000. And with an additional 36,000 daily infections, the total caseload is now nearing 8.2 million. Russia will go into a nationwide workplace shutdown in the first week of November. In the meantime, the situation is somber in neighboring Ukraine, that is registering a record daily high of more than 730 deaths. So far, nearly 65,000 deaths and 2.8 million cases have been reported there. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
When Muslims walk together, January 9th, 2015. I deem it necessary to thank the government, people and different tribes of Iraq who made sacrifices, rendered services, and showed greatness of character in this very important test. Arba'een of Karbala was an astonishing event. The enemies of Islam and Ahlul Bayt vainly thought that they had blocked the path of Muslims. Notice what a great movement was launched when even bodies stay together. It has such a reflection. If we stay together, if Islamic governments and Muslim nations, whether Shia or Sunni, or different denominations of Shia and Sunni, are honest with one another, if they are not suspicious of one another, if they do not insult and have malevolent intentions against one another, notice what will happen in the world and what great dignity will be brought about for Islam. Unity, unity.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. nations should be united.
Muslims should know their real enemies. January 9th, 2015. This is the responsibility of everyone. Today, all Muslims throughout the world should think about the Islamic Ummah and the Islamic unity. If we think of the Islamic Ummah, the interest of our countries will be safeguarded as well. The interest of the enemy lies in separating us from one another. His interest lies in attacking one country and raising an army with the help of another country. His interest lies in this. We should not allow him to do this. Who is the enemy? The enemy is American capitalism and global arrogance, which is headed today by America and the Zionists. The Zionist government in occupied Palestine is part of the dangerous group and the deadly cancer which the Zionists have created in the world. We should stand up against them. We should refer to Islam and Quranic text in order to stand up against them.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements. The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. Since taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Right. The boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method. Be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products, but this has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shataya called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hassan Qassem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel, despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violent international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand
that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
What they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do we stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we're going to talk about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, He migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani, let me ask you this question in this episode that is somehow related to the previous episode where I asked you about making some parts of the mosque ritually impure. If something like that happens, if part of the mosque has been made impure, ritually speaking, all right?
Yeah.
Who's supposed to purify it or clean it? The person who made it impure, or whoever comes to know or realize that this part of the mosque is ritually impure?
Of course, according to Ayatollah Sistani and according to all religious authorities, it is necessary, it is obligatory for a person, for the person who has made impure to purify the mosque. Now, if let's say a child makes the mosque impure, it becomes necessary for the child's father, for the child's guardian, to purify the mosque. And if the child does not have a guardian, or the child's relative is not in a position to purify it, then it becomes a collective obligation of Muslims and people who go to the mosque to purify the mosque as quickly as possible. And whoever does, because a collective obligation means that if one person accepts or undertakes the obligation or fulfills it,
mm-hmm.
or accepts to do it, then other people are relieved of the obligation to purify it. So therefore, if a few people take action to purify the mosque, then other people are no longer under the obligation to purify it. So it is a collective obligation when no one takes action.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And okay. If no one purifies it, then it means that all the people who come to know and who do not take action to purify it, they are sinful.
They are to blame.
They are to blame, yes.
Yes. Okay. Sheikh Javid, if the mosque becomes ritually impure, and, for example, an imagined part of the mosque or the building in the mosque has been made ritually impure, but it cannot be made pure,
sure.
All right?
Yes.
Like by washing, for example, all
yeah.
right? Imagine a brick in the wall, all right?
Yeah.
Is it like, do we have to take that brick out of the wall and then wash it or make it pure and put it back there? What about those places where, like in the ground, like on the floor of the building, do we have to dig that najis part or impure part out?
Ayatollah Sistani says that, since it is necessary to purify the mosque,
mm-hmm.
then any action possible to make it pure is necessary. Even if one has to has to dig a part of the mosque out, like if one has to take out or pull out a brick and wash it and then put it back in its place, or maybe if a person has to dig out the floor and clean it and remove the najasa or the impurity, then one has to do it. Okay, and of course, then if the when you dig the mosque out, you have to put the brick back in its place so that the mosque is made ready for the people to pray there, because the whole and sole goal of the mosque is to pray. Okay, it should be a place where people are able to pray, and therefore, if it becomes necessary to dig out the floor, then it has to be done. But then it should be the floor has to be repaired once again quickly, so that the people may be able to offer their prayers there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back continuing our discussion and laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our guest speaker is still Sheikh Javid. We are still talking about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. And I wanted to ask you, Sheikh Javid, about a challenging type of question. You know, it happens that in some cities or some regions, the road construction or for the sake of road construction, houses, people's houses are demolished, all right?
Sure.
Can, because of the construction of a road, can a house of God, a mosque, be demolished? Is it permissible to do so? Like to demolish a house, the house of God, a mosque, in order to build a road which is kind of necessary for the people to connect, for example, to spots or to places, to dots like A and B, all right?
Yes.
And this road is kind of necessary and indispensable. So can a mosque be demolished this way for the sake of construction of a road?
Well, Ayatollah Sistani and, of course, most of the religious authorities I know stress, and they do say that it's not permissible to demolish a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
This is the basic answer given by the religious authorities, that a mosque, because it is a mosque and it is an endowed property, an endowed property cannot be, you see, demolished, it cannot be destroyed. No matter what the reason. Now, if, for example, in some places, of course, we see that the government or the municipality actually destroys the mosque without taking it into consideration that it is a mosque and it should remain there. But in the case that the mosque is demolished, of course, then the rules which apply to a mosque do not apply to the place where the mosque used to be there, okay, where the mosque used to stand. Now, for example, when it comes to that place where the mosque used to be, of course, you can make it impure. There's no problem because there's no mosque anymore, because there's a road now passing through that place, and but of course, that place is still remains an endowed property. Even though a road passes through that place, but the place where the mosque used to be, it cannot be sold. It cannot be appropriated by other people and it cannot be, let's say, used for any other purposes. For example, but of course, there's no problem in making it impure or in doing something which is considered disrespect to the mosque. But because there's no mosque there now,
mm-hmm.
Doing all those acts which were haram for a mosque, which were haram to do in a mosque or to a mosque, is not haram there in that place where now there is a road passing through.
I see. Very quick question again, Sheikh Chaubi. You know, imagine that a government decides to build a mosque somewhere, and now they come to this decision that a road has to be made or constructed there. And the mosque, in fact, is on the way, yeah. All right, as an obstacle for them. Can they decide to demolish it now, or instead of that mosque, they can dedicate another place and endow it as a mosque next to it?
You know, to dedicate another place instead of that place where a mosque is now already built,
mm-hmm.
Does not become a license for demolishing that mosque. Now, we in modern time, and this time around, I have seen many places, you know, many mosques have been demolished, and of course another mosque elsewhere has been built,
mm-hmm.
to allow people, to mu'mineen or believers, to pray there, to offer their prayers there.
Yes.
Okay, and such a facility has been provided by the government, but it does not become an excuse for the municipality or for the government to demolish that mosque.
Mm-hmm.
The mosque cannot be demolished.
I see.
Now, but if it happens, if the government actually does demolish the mosque, then that mosque ceases to become, the place where the mosque used to be ceases to be a mosque, and therefore any act which used to be haram is now permissible.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
First entered Afghanistan in 2001. I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States' involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq war diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military.